This is episode 267 of the Andrew Hines Real Estate Investing Podcast. Welcome back to the show. Today I have Kyle Pierce on, and Kyle is an investor that is located in the Windsor region of Ontario. Kyle is an entrepreneur through and through, and today we focus on methodical real estate investing. So Kyle's not the guy to just jump in and try and acquire 100 units. He's methodically growing his portfolio in large part because he enjoys doing so. There's no grand goal attached to it. It's just a knowing that it's a good idea to continue to build your real estate portfolio, and he is methodically working through it. So I like that for a change, because not everybody wants to go 1,000 miles an hour. Kyle's up to multiple different entrepreneurial ventures, and he actually was a high school teacher. He may go back to that eventually, but he's on a long sabbatical right now and just enjoying his real estate and entrepreneurial life. So he's invested in the US and in Canada, and we dug into how he goes about that and his philosophy about that. He's also a podcast host himself. So I'm confident you can definitely mine some gold nuggets out of this episode, and I hope you do enjoy. Just before you get right in, if you would kindly take a moment and rate and review this podcast if you haven't already done that. It just helps it grow. The more people who talk about it, share it with their friends, etc., those are the best ways you can give back. If you're enjoying this podcast and you want to say thank you, that's the best thank you you could give me. So I'd really appreciate it. And without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into the episode with Kyle Pierce. Hello and welcome to the Andrew Hines Real Estate Investing Podcast. I have Kyle Pierce on today, and as I was mentioning off camera, I'm familiar with your name. I know you've got a lot going on. So Kyle, first off, thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks for having me, Andrew. It's awesome. Long time listener, first time caller, and I'm really excited to chat with you and connect with your audience a little bit here.
That's fine. That's the first time anyone said that to me on the podcast, but I actually just had somebody say that to me like last week for the first time, like ever. But yeah, that's great.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Cool. Well, why don't you start from the top? You mentioned to me off camera that you're a Windsor guy. Take me back to when you started investing. You know, give me the story of what led to us sitting here today having this conversation.
Yeah, no problem. I'll try to keep it short, but give enough, context, for those people who, if you were to check, some of my social profiles right now, anyway, I change it every now and again. It says social or a serial entrepreneur. And really my story is kind of, quite different than most. I came out of, university. I had been always liked investing, always liked the idea of it, wasn't sure what to do. And I came out and I was going to be a math teacher, a high school math teacher. And that's what I did for the vast majority of my adult life. I was doing that. I had this rock solid pension behind me, but I wasn't satisfied with that by itself. I was the type of person, I didn't live a very lavish lifestyle by any means. Some people might call it a bit of penny pinching going on there, maybe frugality, but ultimately I knew that I wanted to invest. And I went down the real estate rabbit hole while I was teaching. So I just sort of did that passively, began that journey back in about 2000. Well, I guess when I pulled the trigger was back in 2011 in the US, bought a property in Florida, and then the year after in Arizona. And then I kind of, pumped the brakes. I was still teaching, loved my job, still loved the idea of teaching, although I'm not doing that right now. And ultimately started to realize that, as my family started to grow, I had to start looking a little bit more locally, just because, I couldn't keep my ear to the ground like I was in the US at the beginning. So started to build a portfolio around here with a partner, Matt Bigley. He's a local realtor now, former teacher. And that's sort of our journey. We're kind of, the guys that started building this portfolio more for, time freedom, for, building maybe a little bit of a legacy for our family, but never really looking at it as something that we wanted to, say, do full time. We weren't desperate to get out of our jobs by any means. We enjoyed our jobs, and it's kind of led me down a path of entrepreneurship, online businesses. And now most of my days are spent doing corporate wealth management for other folks like myself who end up with, you know, corporations and money there and trying to figure out how do I do this in the most tax efficient way while still having access to capital to continue reinvesting.
Interesting. Like, what's your background to take you into that? Are you like a CPA as well, or you just were an enthusiast and got into it?
Yeah. For those who have ever done the Kolbe test, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the Kolbe test, but you know, if you do the Kolbe, there's four pillars and one is fact finder. And I'm a very high number fact finder on the Kolbe test. And that's really what's led me through everything I've done. You know, the success I've had in education was all about trying to get to the bottom of how do I engage students in math class. You know, shocking. I don't know if you know this, Andrew, but not all kids want to learn math. That was something that was a shock to me when I got into the math classroom, that kids were there and they didn't like math. And I was standing there thinking that they should. The same was true in investing. I went down the rabbit hole, fact finding down that rabbit hole. And then ultimately, when we started running into this whole tax issue, started to recognize that I'm like, you know, as this portfolio builds, ultimately we're going to run into this tax issue that, you know, we're basically going to have to gift half of it to the government unless we do something about it. So I went down that rabbit hole and, you know, call it, you know, reading the tax act and doing all of these things. So I'm not a CPA, but ultimately I put in my like 10,000 hours to try to figure out how can I do this better than what was being recommended to me by, you know, your typical accountant or what you're reading online.
I feel like nowadays with ChatGPT, and I'm not recommending this, but you could put in the relevant sections and ask questions.
And absolutely.
And then dig in deeper. It's never been easier to really dig in and read the actual specific, like let's call it laws that, you know, in their actual original form. So that's, yeah.
Totally.
Interesting. And I do know Matt Bigley. Never met him, but many times we've messaged. So you guys you're one of the three that are investing in that trio, is that right?
The amigos, yes. Yep. He's now full-time, you know, real estate locally here in Windsor, Essex. And again, we still have this growing, you know, real estate portfolio. But again, like by all means, we do not want to be full-time, quote unquote, you know, real estate investors where our bread and butter is sort of, you know, dependent on the next deal. You know, we enjoy the work we do. And so like I said,
sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but you're not trying to live off the property's income?
At some point, sure. But ultimately, you know, for us, I mean, I enjoy the work I've been doing specifically around the wealth management. Matt loves doing the work. He's a connector as well. So, you know, the fact that he's out there and he's, you know, he's kind of in the know as to what's going on in the market. Like, so he loves that aspect. And, you know, I think we look at it as more of like a lifestyle portfolio rather than, you know, at some point, I think the portfolio will get to a point where we might go, do we really want it to be that big? You know, is there something else we could do that would make this more passive, right? So I think we've treated our portfolio as a wealth creator with the goal that maybe it's not necessarily the portfolio itself that's going to be our long-term passive income, but rather that maybe we start shifting some of the equity in that portfolio into more passive investments, which might also mean, you know, maybe lower returns, but lower hassle as well. So that's been sort of a shift that we've been making over time, because I think for many of us, you get into whether it's real estate, the stock market, or like whatever investment you're doing. I think a lot of people get into it because they're like, I know that investing is better than not, but they don't necessarily have exactly why they're doing it, right? Like more money is the easy answer, but for what? Like to achieve what goal and when will I get to that goal? So we've spent a lot of time trying to, you know, we'll call it soul search around why are we doing this anyway? We had as teachers, you know, we had this pension that would probably be enough to live a nice life in retirement. But for us, we wanted more, but we couldn't quite define it. Now I think it's just knowing that, yeah, we'll have that passive income, but I also don't want the hassle as well. So I think there will be a time where we'll slowly divest some of our real estate and start shoving it into some other more passive investments over time.
And what, like, walk me through the type of stuff you guys own, approximate numbers and like locations. Give me an idea of that and how that stresses you from a ownership standpoint. Because whether you're the property manager or asset manager, there's something that goes into it. It does have its tax on you.
Yeah. Over the past few years, we did move towards, you know, management. So we did, you know, bring in property manager and, you know, all of those things. But like people say, it's like now instead of managing the tenants, you are managing the management company, right? And, you know, there's obviously costs associated with it. Even something as simple as I saw an email right before hopping on here that there's a furnace not working in one of the units. And all right, they're going to do that thing. And that's great. But again, it's not easy because every single month is different. You know, there's never a predictable sort of outcome where you go, hey, at the end of this month, there's going to be this much money left over. For us, we've pretty much taken all of our cash flow and we continue just to kind of reinvest it, kind of like with this compounding idea, you know, going in, you know, into force. But the reality is that again, I think the, you know, the wealth creation through principal pay down, appreciation, and then really cash flow for us is more or less just almost like a fund that will help us deal with the unexpected capital expenditures. I could see that if we weren't earning any income and relying solely on that money, that that could be more stressful down the road than say it is now. Like we're not stressed because we don't rely on that income, but I can imagine that there will be a time down the road where that could feel stressful, especially if, you know, we know how things happen, right? It's like, it seems like everything bad happens all at once and then it goes quiet for a while. It's like being okay with that up and down, I think could be maybe a little more stressful, especially later in life.
Yeah. So do you guys have like a rule in terms of like how much money you keep aside per unit or per house? Like, is it houses or apartments?
Yeah, we do a mix of quite a bit. And it really are, I wouldn't call it a rule. I guess it's just been what we've done is that because we haven't had to use the income for our own personal lifestyle that we've just sort of let it go and rolled it back in. So, hey, the next property we have, we might not need to, you know, fund it with a down payment because there's enough, you know, equity or cash in the corporation to do so. Or, you know, we have other assets in there that we might leverage. So not necessarily a rule, just something we haven't needed to do.
So you're not touching it. Like, it's not like you
haven't touched it.
It's not like you reach 100,000 in the account and you start paying out. You guys just leave the money in there.
Sometimes promissory notes, we might, you know, if there's a lot sitting there and we've, you know, lent money to the corporation for a purchase, we might, you know, just take back our promissory note, that sort of thing. But ultimately, you know, the portfolio size right now, we're in like, I want to say 36 doors or so. We, you know, Matt and I each have a couple other, you know, personal owned properties as well that we either purchased before the corporation or, you know, call it private money deals gone bad where now I own a property that I never intended to own. So we typically do residential. We have a mixed use building as well. So we have a few commercial, not exactly our favorite to get into the commercial space. But, you know, anything from, you know, a couple single family homes, we still have some duplexes. We've got, you know, a 9-unit residential. So really anything out there, I would say our bread and butter has always been buying with a margin of safety. So kind of like a Warren Buffett style. It's not necessarily like we're not super flip centric. We're not like Burr guys. I would say over time, we will do what you're doing with a Burr, but we're not in a rush because we have no need, you know, to get that capital out. And
so you guys aren't going rapid acquisition. You're methodical.
I would say very methodical. We a lot of times it was really hard. Like it was hard to avoid the FOMO, especially during this massive run up we've seen over the last couple of years. Like, you know, we were always sitting there going like, seems like everybody's, you know, buying more. And for us, it was like, it doesn't make sense on a cash flow perspective. It's like either it's got to be cash flowing or at least, you know, the cash flow you can see, you have a clear path towards where you are going to be cash flowing, that we would say no. So we said no to a lot of deals. And, you know, I would argue early in our journey, we were saying no to deals that weren't cash flowing enough. And now we look at that as a regret, you know? Yeah. We're like, what were we, you know, I was like, we were looking for home runs every, you know, every time and you could find them. But now I'm like, shoot, we should have said yes to all those deals. And then, you know, you go through the last couple of years and you're like, holy smokes, it's so hard to find unless you're finding something off market or just like right time, right place. But yeah, that's been our style, not a rush.
Yeah.
And we're just trying to make sure that, you know, we're pumping the brakes when, you know, things aren't making sense, because it's really easy to fall, you know, fall into that trap of just buying the next deal because you haven't in a while.
Yeah. And you know, it depends on when you started, because the people who all started in like 2016, 17, 18, like they never knew a market that wasn't accelerating and going up in value like crazy. When I started investing in 2011 in London, things weren't going up at all. Like we weren't even getting inflation. We were just stagnant. Yep. So because of that, it just, you know, that's what I got used to. I kind of came to terms with that. I actually kind of like that because it makes things predictable. If you're flipping, you know what you're getting into. If you're doing value add, you know what you're getting into. The increasing market always seems so unsustainable to me, and it actually just ticked me off. And after a couple of years in that, I'm like, yeah, I'm kind of done really trying to acquire. I'm going to just wait and see what happens. Of course, I ended up waiting a few extra years. We bought our camp in 2021, but I didn't buy anything from 18, 19, 20. Didn't buy anything in those 3 years. And I just didn't like the way things were going. And, you know, in hindsight, that was obviously not the right move. But I think the right move was to learn the skills, get better at acquisition, and buy at a better price so that you're not a victim of the market. But, you know, it took time and perspective for me to come to terms with that. I know that's not the model you guys are employing, but you're not trying to grow super fast, right? So you've basically fired yourself as a teacher. You're not doing that right now. You shook off the golden handcuffs, or they still got you a little bit.
You know what? I will tell you, I am the type of person, my primal question is, you know, am I secure, like from a financial perspective? And, you know, so I seek some of that. I think that's also, you know, why as I described earlier, that over time, like there will probably be this, you know, gradual shift. I think I'll always want to take advantage of an opportunity in real estate. But I think that's one of the big pieces, like you were saying, is like, if sometimes, you know, we're encouraged out there, you know, thinking abundantly and thinking about setting goals. So, you know, for example, someone might set an arbitrary goal for 100 doors. I know for a while, Matt and I, that was our goal, was 100 doors by X year. This was a number of years ago. And I'm telling you, it was like, it almost put us in a bad spot because we almost said yes to things trying to reach the goal instead of thinking, you know, with our heads and going, no, it doesn't actually make sense right now. So, you know, I think for those people listening, if there's a takeaway that, you know, anyone out there can take from the conversation we're having right now, is like really trying to figure out, what are you doing it for? And one thing that I think in, you know, human nature is like ego. It's like, it's hard for people to not want to be the best at whatever it is they're doing, right? So you go like, well, I want to be the best real estate investor. So in order to be the best, I got to have as many doors as this next guy, or, you know, whatever it might be. But in reality, it's like thinking about like, why am I doing it? Like, why are we doing it? And I think for Matt and I, we talked about, you know, the whole personal beliefs thing for a number of years, trying to figure out what is it that we're doing this for other than big number, you know, because that's an easy out that, but like, when will I know that we've achieved what it is that we were after? And that's where we've really started to reset ourselves over these last couple of years. So we look for deals. If there's a great deal that we can put capital into, we're all for it. But if not, then we don't, you know, and just try to figure out what makes most sense at the time for investing, where we're not going to feel like, hey, we made a poor choice, or we, you know, stepped outside of the lines of the sandbox that we want to set for ourselves in terms of how we're going to grow. And ultimately, you know, it really came back to us saying, you know what, we actually don't want to be full-time real estate investors. We just want to be investors and hopefully benefit over time from it. So that's been our strategy, and, you know, maybe boring, but
boring's good, man. If you can stick with boring and you can be consistent with boring, that will pay off big time. You know, a lot of people are, I am the impatient type. Like I want to grow. but boring is very good. It's, you know, if you can be patient, you can win because time tends to cure all wounds in real estate. Not always. And in current years, it may not, but I think generally speaking, it is, especially if you've got the cash flow and you didn't go buy in an extreme bubble, then, you know, generally speaking, you should be all right. And for you guys, spreading it out over time the way you have also is a mitigation too. So some of your properties probably went up. You probably had a couple that had maybe not gone up, but maybe went down a little overall.
Yeah.
But your portfolio as an average is probably still quite, let's call it in a low leverage or medium leverage scenario.
Absolutely. And that's something too that these past few years with interest rates rising and things like that, it really, you know, I think there was a time as well, like this FOMO kind of feeling that we had. We were like, wow, we have certain properties that have a lot of equity in them. And like I said, we weren't like active burrs, you know, we weren't looking to refinance and get onto the next one immediately. Like we actually were struggling to find deals. So we're like, well, there's no point in refinancing. So we just kind of hung tight. And in a way, it's a bit of a blessing in disguise because now we look at the portfolio and the loan to value of the portfolio is pretty, you know, conservative, which is great. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when those loans do come up over the next, you know, some of them are going to be coming up, say, next year. I'm hoping rates will start falling, you know, this year as well. A lot of people are anticipating it does, but it doesn't really matter at the end of the day because we're not, you know, leveraged to the gills trying to, you know, get all of this money out and put it somewhere else. It really kind of, you know, keeps you on an even keel and puts you in a position where, hey, listen, even if rates are a little higher, hey, now we have the equity in that property that we could stretch it out and still have the same payment to stay cash flow positive if we choose, right? So it just gives you a
little more flexibility. You could just remortgage it, not to take more, but to extend your amortization so that you know the cash flow stays there. If it didn't and you had some of these mortgages renew, would they turn cash negative?
I mean, I would say if we were mortgaged up to say 80% or even 70% on some of the large multifamily, if we were, you know, if we had refied all of that money out in the last 12 months, then I'm going to guess it probably would go cash flow negative just because of rates and, you know, we all know rents, like everyone in Ontario loves how the rents go up so slowly, right? So, I mean, ultimately at the end of the day, I would argue on some of the buildings, it probably would, right? Which is why prices are falling. You know, it's hard to sell a building to somebody at 18 months ago prices when rates are high and, you know, it's not going to cash flow, right? So it just kind of doesn't make sense. Really just makes you think, hey, what's my goal? And why did I buy these properties anyway? And do I have to take every dollar of equity out of every property to try to maximize everything? Or is it, you know, a little bit better? Do I sleep a little better at night if I know that, hey, I've got, you know, a little bit extra, you know, equity tucked under the cap there?
Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, I don't want to be leveraged right to the max on anything, especially when you see what can happen. Which, you know, a lot of people are feeling the pain of that. So
for sure. Yeah,
good on you guys for being methodical about that. And how are you finding? So here's my main curiosity now in a market where I think much of Ontario, people are still not sure. Are values going up? Are they coming down? Mm-hmm. I mean, in Toronto proper, they've been going up. But and there's some anticipation of the rate cuts, which caused people to spend maybe a little bit and heat things up a bit. But nobody really knows where prices are going. So knowing that, how are you guys finding deals right now? You just pointed out that people still want prices from 2 years ago, which that makes it hard because what worked 2 years ago doesn't necessarily work now unless you're using like MLI Select, going to, you know, high LTVs and, you know, 50-year amortizations and stuff. And those scenarios still work. But I mean, that's a double-edged sword, in my opinion. So what are you seeing? Yeah. How are you guys making it work? Are you still looking at deals? Are you still buying deals?
Yeah, like luckily for us, well, I would say this. We still watch the MLS. But very quickly, you know, we kind of know whether it's, you know, people always say you want to always be underwriting deals, just, you know, mm-hmm. staying on top of things. So we're always watching, but it is hard right now to find something on MLS that is going to work. And then when something does catch your eye, then you notice like, oh, they're actually trying to do the whole war thing still, you know, like they're every now and again, you'll see a property go up on MLS with that as the intended goal. So we always just say, you know what, we'll wait and see if it sticks around past that date and we'll go from there. But really what we've been doing lately, like we had closed on a duplex and a single family home, and they were both, you know, private deals, just kind of scenarios. I was working with a corporate wealth client, and you know, they had a property that they were looking to move on from. It needed a lot of work. They knew that they weren't going to get a great, you know, price if they threw it on MLS. So we worked out a deal to, you know, like, what do you want to get out of it? What do you need, you know, and make it win-win on both sides. And I'm finding, you know, for guys like us who aren't, you know, in a rush, we're not in a hurry, it makes it easier for us to be able to go, you know what, if we can find a good deal for us and still make it a good deal for the seller, you can get really creative, you know? So some of these VTBs that people are willing to do, a lot of times what I'll do is I'll come to the seller and I'll say, listen, if we go cash and I go, you know, we do our own financing, here's the numbers, and I'll show them the cash flow numbers that here, we're like cash flow neutral with current rents. We're going to have to put X number of dollars in. I'm like, so we can offer you this amount, or we can do a VTB and we can make it this number if you're willing to do it interest only at a, you know, a reasonable rate, blah, blah, blah. We could do that number, you know, like you want the higher number, let's do VTB. You want lower number, then we can go this way. And, you know, we just kind of make it as transparent as possible. It's like it either works for you or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, that's okay too, because we're not in a hurry. We're not in a rush. We're not going to mm-hmm. be emotional about it. Yeah. And it really has served us well. And I think it's served a lot of sellers well too, because it's easy for us to forget that people oftentimes are like, they don't want to deal with hassle. So there's a lot of people out there that are like, I don't want to have to deal with actually selling this property. Like that's like a stressful event for some mm-hmm. people, even investors, or maybe investors that just want to get out now that the market is, you know, kind of shaky in a lot of people's minds. Mm-hmm. For guys like us, we're like, yeah, it's okay if the market's shaky, as long as we're not putting ourselves in a spot where we're cash flow negative. We're okay to do that, because like you said, time, let her roll, and you know, we're confident that things, you know, the ocean's gonna lift all ships, or whatever the saying is there, right?
Rising tide raises all ships, right?
There it is. I should have practiced that one before I hopped on.
No, it makes sense. So you are getting deals done. Like, when's the last one you tied up? Was it in the last 12 months?
Oh yeah. We did two in November, but before that, I would say it was probably almost 10 months before that, when we found one. We're not actively, again, like we're not like dropping letters, we're not cold calling. It's more or less
because just that goes back to the networking. Why. Goes back to the why. So you guys are just putting feelers out there because you're not in a major hurry to grow it. Right now it's a nice thing to have. You know, it will be beneficial, and that's really where it is. So you guys both do your active thing, got out of teaching because you found something that you enjoy more, I'm guessing, overall.
For me, I think I'm a creature of change. I love, you know, like I said, I still love teaching, which is, I think, why I do a lot of the work I do on the wealth.
Because you're still educating. Side. Yeah.
Exactly. You get to go out there. When I podcast, I have a podcast called Canadian Wealth Secrets, and I love doing all of that work. It's just funny that I think humans in general, we tend to, you know, get an identity and develop an identity around whatever choice we made at some point in life. And it's like, you know, when people say I was born to be a high school math teacher or something, it's like, well, not really. It's like you had certain skills that allows you to, you know, bring forward, but I'm not a high school math teacher. I'm a guy, I'm a connector. I'm a teacher. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I'm a fact finder. I love going down the rabbit hole and sharing what I found with other people. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people out there that might be in a day-to-day job and they sort of identify themselves as a thing. Real estate investor might be one.
Yeah,
I'm a full-time real estate investor. And it's like, well, I mean, that's how you're putting food on the table now, but you could be all kinds of other things too. So we're kind of in this part of our life where we're going, you know, be really cool if I was talking to my grandkids one day and I could tell them like all these stories and like, I thought you were a teacher. And I'm like, yeah, but I was also this and I was also that. And I did all these different things because we only have so many, you know, so many years here on this planet. We don't know how long it's going to be. So why not explore it, try it, and then see what brings you the most joy.
Yeah, great point. So as far as the teaching gig goes, like, are you fully out or you have the ability to go back? Are you on like a sabbatical of some sort?
Yeah, it's a very, very generous sabbatical that they've given, which is awesome. So that gave me a lot of sort of freedom to go and explore and try different things. Mm-hmm. You know, I also have an active consulting business that another partner, John Orr and I have been running, you know, for the past 10 years, again, serial entrepreneurs. So he's sort of, you know, running the show over there while I'm, you know, mm-hmm. in this, you know, corporate wealth management world, helping other business owners. And it's been such an awesome opportunity to be able to explore. And, you know, while I would love for that sabbatical to sort of last forever as the option, I certainly have appreciated, you know, me being able to fully control my day, my schedule, mm-hmm. to, you know, do things I wasn't able to do with my family, for example, you know, in the mornings, in the evenings, coaching their teams. There was a lot going on in the role. Mm-hmm. I was a K-12 math consultant for almost a decade in the local school board here and loved the work. But again, it was a lot of, you know, a lot of hours, a lot of work, a lot mm-hmm. of stress. And, you know, I've definitely felt a lot looser, a lot easier, less weight on the shoulders doing some of this work, which suggests to me that, you know, the universe is sort of telling me that, hey, you know, you found your calling for now anyway over in this world.
Yeah, it's quite the change. So if they call you up and tell you got to come back by the end of the year, or is that a possibility?
I guess they could. I think right now they've allowed up until the beginning of next year. But ultimately, you know, like even my wife has said, you know, many times, she's just like, you're just way more calm. Like I'm a very, mm-hmm. people would say that I'm a pretty like patient, calm, easygoing type person, but I'm the type that, you know, I kind of like, I wear the stress differently. I kind of hold it mm-hmm. in. And, you know, she senses, you know, sort of like this more free version of myself. And, you know, so it'd be a hard thing to say, yeah, you know what, I'm going to hop right back into that world and, you know, go down that rabbit hole. But who knows, you know, I never want to close a door on any opportunity. Sure. That's for sure.
Yeah. So going back to teaching is a possibility, although you're enjoying what you're doing.
I'm loving it. Yeah. It's it's fantastic. It's like, you know, picture, well, let's put it this way. You know, I described it a little earlier. It's like, I spent a long time finding ways and had some success with it actually, you know, helping students to enjoy math and teaching math. Mm-hmm. But when I'm doing the work I'm doing now, it's like, everybody is interested in what you have to share, right? Because they're like, wow, if this could benefit me, if I could pay, you know, less passive income taxes inside of my corporation or pay less personal taxes by, you know, employing strategies that are compliant.
Yeah.
People are all in, right? And they're like so eager. They're not sitting there, you know, falling asleep or on their phone. And, you know, you're trying to, you know, teach them to distributive property or some other thing that they're not seeing as being connected to their life. It's mm-hmm. It's definitely a different experience. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. No, it sounds like, I mean, for me, I'm being an entrepreneur my whole like adult life. I get it. I've never been great at, you know, working a job. I wanted to do my own thing and, keeps it interesting, right? You adapt with the times, you change what you're doing if it's not working exact. Whereas if you're working a job, you do what they tell you. So you have the ability, because the market could change next year. They don't want your service the way you do it. You might have to change, or the tax laws change and you change to adapt. And it keeps things fresh. So that's absolutely for sure. I do want to look at one of your deals. So like, let's say, what's the most recent one you bought? What was it?
Most recent one was a duplex in actually in a, well, I'll call it a part of Windsor that isn't our favorite
part. We'll put it that way, but it definitely was worthwhile. And
did it need work, or was it ready to go?
I would call it, let's put it this way. It is ready to work, but not probably for your average person. So there were tenants in there. One tenant was not paying. And this particular, like that was really causing stress for the owner, which is what kind of led us to even explore this opportunity. So that's where, you know, we had given them, you know, some options. We knew what the market value could be maybe on MLS, but with this non-paying tenant in the unit, and obviously we know how wonderful that can be for landlord tenant board, you know, we got creative and basically gave them the two offers and said, hey, if you want a VTB, then we'll go and we can give you a higher amount, you know, closer to what you're hoping for. Or if you want us to take it, walk away, no issues, whatever, we'll deal with the tenant ourselves. We can offer you this amount and we'll go get, you know, our regular, you know, mortgage like we would from whatever lender. So
I love the dual offer thing. That's great. Yeah. Okay. So what'd you end up getting this one for?
So this one, we ended up getting it for $300, and it's a duplex here in Windsor.
And did you put any reno into it? Or
we are actually just at, so this deal closed in November. I want to say it was November 10th-ish.
Yeah.
And the landlord tenant board gave the date like a month later. So it was like the timing couldn't have been better because they had already filed.
Okay.
And, you know, so they're just waiting. And it was like a month after in December when they said, hey, the date's going to be January, whatever. And went through, got the eviction. And now the tenant is officially out as of like, I would call it maybe a week or two ago. We're recording this in February. So the timing of that worked out much better than we thought it was going to work out. So that tenant's out. So we're now going through quotes and things to get that bottom unit sort of redone. It's let's say requires a little bit of love is what I'll tell you there.
How much love? Are we talking $100,000 of love?
No, I would say I'm going to be happy if we can do the bottom for, I would say, about 20 or lower. I think 20,000 is going to be more than enough.
Okay.
And that was something we kind of factored into, you know, knowing that that was, you know, going to be some capital out of pocket once this tenant moves on. In one way, there's a positive as well. Like, so the two tenants were supposed to be paying $1,550 and $1,555 between the upper unit and the bottom unit.
So 1% rule you would have got.
It was exactly. So it was like, now we knew one wasn't paying, but we ran the numbers that way and we went, oh man, like this is okay. Not exactly in the neighborhood that, you know, we're loving, to be honest, but close to the university. So, you know, there's some benefit there. And now that that bottom unit tenant's going to be moving out, we're going to be looking to get closer to like, you know, 1950, something like that. So after we put a little bit of this capital in, and our hope, because right now when we took it, the for whatever reason, they had the landlord paying all utilities. There's three separate hydro meters, but there's a single gas meter that fuels a single furnace. And then the heat rises and they have baseboards in the upstairs and then a single water meter. So more benefit to come because now the utilities, at least for hydro, are going to be, you know, the tenant paying and likely the gas the tenant will be paying. And then we'll, you know, we'll take care of the water. So lots of lift there available on this unit.
So in your sort of pro forma, you'd be closer to about $3,500 a month in rent with only a water bill. So say what, like 160, 170 a month on average?
Exactly. Like I'm running these numbers down right now. I just pulled it back up. It's been a while since I did it, but yeah. So if I cut out this hydro, we'd be looking at now this is assuming, that we're just looking on the $300,000, not considering the additional capital going in, but you know, we're looking at like, you know, 785 in positive cash flow once this work, you know, happens, yeah, right? Which yeah. we haven't seen since before COVID.
No, you're going to have some carrying costs in there. So you bought with a bank mortgage, did you?
Yeah. So we actually went to one of the credit unions. They were great. Offered us 6.5%, which not too bad. The numbers ran easily at that. So, you know, we didn't really have a concern there. And then
25-year AM on that.
Exactly. Yeah.
25. Yeah. Yeah. So tax value, I'm just going to get some ballpark numbers here. Would you be like $3,500 a year in taxes on that?
Taxes are actually a little less. They're about $2,600 in that unit.
And then insurance on that would be like $2,500 a year.
I think it's coming in around $2,200.
Okay. And then maintenance, I'll just leave 5%, although, you know, on something like that, some of your maintenance can be a bit higher. I'll leave that there for now. Sure. Utilities, I got management. You guys are self-managing?
No, we do have a management company. So about 7.5% is what we have through them.
Good thing I asked. Okay. So just to put that in perspective, so you wouldn't have any landscaping, right? Because they're going to cut their own, or one of them will. And then no snow removal. So I got a $500 miscellaneous there. So you're going to have basically at 325, say that's where you come in with carrying costs. You're like 8.9% cap rate. Sounds like a good deal.
Not bad. I mean,
obviously there's a little bit of a headache and you got some management, but yeah, you said it, you were in the 700s for cash flow. That's what I got here.
Totally.
That's assuming you were financing 75% of that 325, which I know you're not financing that whole amount. You're doing 75% of 300.
Exactly. And like we said too, it's like, you know, we could do improvement on the main, which we are. And then we're hoping we're going to offer it to the upper tenants and, you know, see if they want to come down, pay, you know, the new rent under the new terms, be in a nicer unit, and then do the same to the upper unit. Mm-hmm. And then the logical next step would be to refinance at that point. But guys like us,
you don't need to,
who knows, you know, we don't have a rush to do it. So, you know, we'll probably let it go and, you know, and we'll just slowly hack away over time. And, you know, we always say, hey, if there's a buyer out there that, you know, likes it and wants it, maybe we might throw, you know what I mean? Throw that out there. Cause again, it's not a neighborhood we typically buy in. We often buy in like some of the surrounding communities of Windsor, to be honest.
Yeah.
That's kind of our, you know, that's been our bread and butter, but ultimately though, you know, again, when these deals come up, we're willing to, you know, to dive in, you know, feet first, of course, because hey, even if this tenant wasn't paying for a while, you know, we were in a situation where we were at least close to cash flow neutral, which, you know, put us in a spot where we went, okay, well, as long as we can get this tenant out within the next X number of months, you know, where are we going to be there? Yeah. And of course, you know, definitely worth the risk for us.
So if you break this all down, I'm estimating 0% appreciation because we really don't know. I'm just putting it at zero. Although in the long run, I mean, I think 1 or 2% is very reasonable. You know, at $100,000 in plus your closing costs and land transfer, it's still about a 15% annual return, including pay down.
Totally.
If you finance a bit more of it, you know, if you get 75% of what you're all in for, you're closer to 20% overall return, which not a lot of people are doing that right now. You know, a lot of people, when you calculate those numbers, work them backwards, they're a lot closer to 10% right now.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, when you even think about just the forced appreciation, you know, once this bottom unit's turned over, once we do the top unit, few things on the exterior I'd like to see done, you know, the siding is definitely aged and worn, you know, call it 50,000, you know, in, you could probably market it for, you know, somewhere in the low to mid fours. So right there, there's some forced appreciation.
So you got an opportunity to sell it if you want. Yeah,
exactly. It's like, maybe we go that route. Maybe we just hang on to it. Cause again, we're not, you know, we're not in a, in a situation where we're like, we can't get into another deal without, you know, pulling the equity from there. We'll just, you know, we'll take what we can get when they come and, you know, obviously keeping our ears to the ground and try to jump on them whenever we can.
Very cool. All right. So Kyle, is there anything else you'd hoped to share that I haven't asked you about?
No, I think that's about it. I mean, for me, I hope, you know, the angle I was trying to, you know, think about before I came on this episode was trying to think a little bit, maybe a little bit differently than a lot of folks that are interviewed on investment shows, real estate investor shows, where, you know, it seems like everything's about maximizing, maximizing. And I hope some people got maybe permission that maybe they're in a different spot and, you know, that you can still be a really successful investor if you define the terms on what success is for you, right? It doesn't have to be, you know, JV partners, and it doesn't have, you know, it doesn't have to be all of those things. They're all great for certain people, but there's so many different ways that you can get involved into real estate investing. And, you know, it doesn't always have to be about maximizing every single return all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Valid point. Yeah. You gotta talk about, think about your why, think about what you're trying to accomplish and make sure your plan's congruent. You know, going for the big number just for the sake of it isn't good advice, I don't think. So, cool. And Kyle, where do people find you and learn more?
Hey, if you're listening to this on your favorite podcast app, you know, open it up and search for Canadian Wealth Secrets. Our website's CanadianWealthSecrets.com. And hopefully on the podcast, we'll have Andrew on the show at some point real soon to talk about your Canadian Wealth Secret sauce. That's something we like to do with the guests we bring on. So
sure.
Hopefully we'll catch some of them there.
Yeah, sounds good. Okay, well, thanks for doing this, and I'll make sure we put a link to your podcast in the show notes for our listeners and viewers.
Awesome! Thanks so much for having me, Andrew. It means a lot.
All right, likewise. Okay, talk soon.